This is the time now that we're going to turn our attention to Neil Smith, who is our first speaker. Neil is at CUNY, which is in New York City, but he actually currently is in Barcelona. In reality, he's my neighbor down the street in Toronto, so I'm all confused. Neil is talking to us today about urbanization after neoliberalism, city building, and the right to the city. Neil, take it away.
Welcome back again after what I hope was a very nice lunch. And I just want to add my thanks to all of the organizers for including me in this and including all of you. It's a tremendous gathering for a tremendous purpose, and I hope that something tremendous politically comes out of it as well. That would certainly be in the spirit of Peter Marcuse's work. I had met Peter before, but my first serious engagement with him came in 1982. And in that year, I moved to Columbia University. And it turns out that Peter was exactly the same age then as I am now. Now, when I got to Columbia, it was very clear to me that this was a man who was already aged. So I would like to take this opportunity first just to revise that obviously very hasty, youthful, and thoroughly erroneous judgment about Peter, and to admit that he's still youthful all these years, and probably still about my age, I think. He was welcoming at Columbia when I went there. I was a junior professor, he was welcoming enough that, among other things, he included me on some PhD dissertation committees, the most notable of which I remember, and I'm going to out Peter here, the most notable was his student, Richard Florida, of Creative Cities claim. I think it's so long after the fact that that took place that I can actually reveal perhaps a little of what happened that day. Despite the committee really pressing Mr. Florida, as I recall it at least, we became convinced, I think, as a committee, that he really hadn't learned anything in graduate school, that he was saying the same things he was saying when he came in, and that he's actually still saying now. So, although it was never explicitly said, when the candidate was asked to leave the room, my sense was that there was a rather dark mood in the committee, a mood of frustration, but also a sense that really we only had two choices. We could pass him or we could shoot him. We clearly made the wrong decision. With the benefit of hindsight, let me just say that this demonstrates a lamentable failure of political initiative on our collective part. And it has contributed, I think, to an entirely preventable future intensification of certain aspects of neoliberal urbanism. So let me, on behalf of us all, I'll certainly speak for myself, apologize profusely, and I hope that you can forgive us. Touché. Peter Marcuse's urban research and his writings have always engaged global processes with local sensibilities. His work is marked by disarmingly simple, if I think absolutely vital, questions, then followed by difficult, often complicated answers, which somehow provide qualified political resolution to the initial conundrum, but which in the process then open up a whole covey of new questions. In that spirit, and with the ongoing meltdown of financial capitalism as a backdrop, I want to ask what post-neoliberal urbanization or urbanism will look like. Now, as Peter would inevitably say, the first obligation is to critique the question. Epochal claims that we are entering a post-neoliberal world, whether they come from the left or from the right, generally appeal to the dramatic waves of bankruptcies, bailouts, nationalizations in Europe and North America since 2007, but peaking last month. The state has not only injected itself back into the arteries of financial capitalism, but has increasingly actually provided the lifeblood for that very capitalism. A new global architecture of finance with the state centrally involved, effectively a new Bretton Woods for the 21st century, is already in utero. But this represents a post-neoliberal world only to the extent that we accept the self-definition and conceits of neoliberalism itself. If, in fact, we argue, and I think this is what we have to be arguing, that the state has always been centrally involved in regulating the financial system on behalf of some class interests over others, even while the neoliberal ideologues of the state championed the merits of a free market unfettered by the state, then I think a rather different picture emerges. We're certainly witnessing the death of a certain kind of neoliberal ideology, that of a stateless market, such as we have known it. But neoliberalism was always a far more cunning and far more primal strategy than its public face. It was always a class project of the state at all the various scales at which the state operates. At best, neoliberalism represented a purified capitalism, a capitalism largely purified of the need, in many places at least, certainly in the core, the need to wage explicit extra-market class struggle, whether in the streets or over the state. Now, however, global economic crisis has melted that ideological ice cap, and capitalists themselves are anxiously redefining capitalism, rediscovering the word, in fact, now that its bedrock is exposed once more. The US, to take perhaps the most dramatic case, but by no means the only one, has now underwritten an estimated $5.8 trillion worth of capitalist debt, a sum equivalent to more than a third, possibly as much as 40% of this year's annual GDP. The ideological camouflage of neoliberalism then has dissolved into toxic financial waste. So what will this post-meltdown modernization, urbanization look like? What will be the new architecture of the urban problematic, to put it in Lefebvre's terms? The depression of the 1920s and the 1930s, the precise dates varied geographically, ushered in a new urban regime. And it's entirely possible, I think, that we're looking at a similar scale of transformation in the urban problematic. At that time, in Europe and North America, massive disinvestment from the built environment prepared the way for an unprecedented resumption of suburbanization following World War II. An authoritarian repression of class struggle certainly existed, but it was matched by the proliferation of reformist measures aimed at buttressing the process of social reproduction and staving off revolution. Public housing, medical and education benefits, social security, unemployment benefits, at least in North America and Europe, these were the stock and trade of the day. In Latin America, as dependista theorists have it, a window of independence from the global market in those days brought a wave of city building. In Africa and Asia, colonial and comprador regimes kept a lid on urban growth, while independence movements mushroomed. The crisis this time, though, is crucially different from the Great Depression. The level of global integration is much more intense today. Thus, in 1929 and 1933, it was the small banks that were predominantly the target, at least of the earliest bankruptcies. Today, it is the world's largest banks. And this is not unrelated to the fact that what triggered today's crisis was actually a crisis in the US housing market, the subprime market, to be specific. And more broadly, the wave of post-1970s city building, which may have been geographically and demographically intense in Shanghai and São Paulo, but which was financially intense in Europe, North America, and till the early 1990s, Japan. Even despite the political and economic crises that marked a decade after the late 1960s, and which neoliberalized post-depression urbanization, 20th century urbanism became an increasingly trenchant vehicle for capital accumulation. By the 1990s, financial risk flooded up the economic hierarchy as fast as mortgages and other debt could be securitized, leveraged, hedged, and otherwise financialized. Thus, if one takes contemporary Cleveland in Ohio as an example, a three-layer overlay of subprime mortgage failures, African-American residential home ownership, and failed mortgages held by Deutsche Bank, it's an almost exact fit. Now, the point here is not that Deutsche Bank was selling mortgages in Cleveland. What Deutsche Bank was doing, of course, was buying up mortgages made by far more local entities in Cleveland. So there's an immediate, albeit uneven, comprehensiveness from above in the present crisis that took much longer to develop in the 1930s. Now, I think that three specific trajectories look likely in the present predicament, and these are all engulfed in a large further question mark. First and most obviously, the seizure of the credit markets, sometimes dramatic crash of housing markets, broader if uneven cessation of real estate development will lead, indeed it already has led, I think, to an intensification of disinvestment and a widespread devaluation of capital in the built environment. Even a cautious re-stimulation of the credit markets, which hasn't yet happened, is unlikely to have any short-term effect on reviving real estate development. The geography of this disinvestment is to some extent predictable. It will be widespread for sure, but it will be concentrated in areas of working class home ownership, as well as renting, but home ownership in particular, where residents have least in the way of assets, where rising unemployment will have the greatest effect, and where credit markets will be most averse to resuming lending. This means remaining working class neighbourhoods in central cities will be especially targeted, but it also implies disinvestment in older outer suburbs, whether in Europe or elsewhere, and an intensified outward diffusion of disinvestment into suburbs lying outside city centres. Again, the specific geographies here are quite uneven and varied. Increased displacement and homelessness, topics on which, of course, Peter Marcuse has done pioneering work, are almost the inevitable, certainly quite predictable result. Entire neighbourhoods, most deeply affected by the subprime crisis, at least in the United States, could face abandonment in the face of what really is a capitalist Katrina. But such a scenario is perhaps more tempered, I think, in many parts of Europe. On both continents, to the extent that the crisis leads to financial but not social economic regime shift, that the basic logics of capitalism remain in place, even if they're transformed, then I think that this disinvestment will prepare the ground for eventual gentrification on a scale that we haven't yet seen, an increased suburbanization of that process. All of this, of course, will happen uneasily and unevenly. The second trajectory, I think much less clear and probably even more contingent, is the urban transformation that will result outside the Euro-North American core. On the one hand, the kind of comparative independence enjoyed by Latin American urbanism in the 1930s seems much less likely to be repeated in an age of global financial integration and coordinated stock markets. The American economic crisis this time left no exceptions, no stones left unturned. As financial speculation and hedge capitalism are ruthlessly brought back into the orbit of produced value, how will the slash-and-burn geography of devaluation be spread around? To the extent that industrial powerhouse cities such as Shanghai represent the cutting edge of a new global urbanism, their fate is very much tied to the productive as much as the financial economy, massive holdings of US Treasury bonds notwithstanding. Should the Chinese economy maintain a more modest but still positive growth as other economies become depressed, one can anticipate a continued comparative shift of power to such cities. but especially given the independence of that, the dependence of that economy, the Chinese economy, on exports, it's difficult to see how Chinese growth will ride out global decline without expanding the domestic market. And of course, this brings its own contradictions, because of course, an expanded domestic market requires an expanded wage rates, which of course undercuts the reinvestment. To the extent that the Chinese economy also sinks into recession, not only will there be disinvestment in the urban environment, but in a country where some 74,000 officially admitted demonstrations, riots, and other violent protests happened in 2005 alone, making it really the unparalleled leader today in class struggle, China. The level of popular urban resistance and organization will be crucial, throwing up the possibility of very different kinds of urban outcomes. Now, the third trajectory I think that's important is the question of how the state will respond to the crisis. And quite apart from already executed bailouts for the capitalist classes around the world, perhaps somewhat more modulated in Europe than in North America, or at least in the US, and the designs of a new financial architecture that will inevitably take over from the dregs of post-war Bretton Woods, how will states respond politically, and what are the implications for future urbanism? There seem to me to be two somewhat contrasting possibilities. The response after 1929, yes, was repressive, but it was also reformist, as I've suggested. And entire structures of state support for social reproduction were generated, leading to what has been called, in the literatures that I think many of us are familiar with, the Keynesian city, wherein the state was openly and politically involved in city building. Whether through tower blocks or housing estates or public infrastructure, the state became a central planner in partnership with capital of the urban built environment. Now, the results of this were obviously far from uniform internationally, and there are many parts of the world that really did not experience the Keynesian city. But it's possible that a similar similarly epochal shift of such a scale could happen this time around. What it would look like, what it would mean for the restructuring of the urban problematic, I think is still barely on the horizon. But by contrast, the state could go the other way. In quite varied ways, the 1970s neoliberalism spawned an authoritarian state in which the response to working class, subaltern, immigrant, and many, many other kinds of demands were seriously upended and repressed. As you know very well, here in Berlin, already established repressive policies were opportunistically intensified, sometimes to farcical, yet at the same time totally dangerous levels, with the so-called war on terrorism. It should always be kept in mind, of course, that many cities, especially in Latin America but elsewhere, always had experienced a militarized public space. Which option is squeezed out from the present crisis, whether a new urban reformism offering urban renewal with a social face or a retrenched urban authoritarianism, is really not yet clear. And so the final thing I need to mention is what I referred to as the question mark engulfing the entire scenario of possibilities. As with the reformist response in the 1930s, there was nothing inevitable about the remilitarized city of neoliberal capital. It represents an expression of quite asymmetric class and social struggles, the one-sided post-1960s victory of the bourgeoisie. The ruling classes of recent decades militarized the city to a greater or lesser extent. From Rio to New York to Beijing, because they could. They did it because they could. Whether a new urban reformism is forced onto the agenda or not depends very much on the levels and extents and effectiveness of protests, political organizing, and revolts that may already be in train. Now, this is not just to say or in any way to argue that a new reformist urbanism marks the outer edge of the possible. Mild or even more radical steps toward, I think, democratizing the capitalist state or redistributing some of the global surplus value suddenly seem not just unambitious, but almost irrelevant at this point. As the capitalist class is forced to defend capitalism in quite explicit terms, there has never been a more opportune moment in the last four decades to make quite revolutionary political demands. Slivoj Žižek, has recently asked with quite extraordinary insight, why is it easier for us these days to imagine total nuclear destruction of the Earth than it is to imagine the end of capitalism? The response has in fact got to be, in many ways, the kinds of response that Lefebvre was talking about in Urban Revolution and in the book The Right to the City, which he published immediately beforehand. A lot has been said about the right to the city, so in finishing, I'm not going to get into that argument further. Peter himself, as I think, explained the combination of the cry and the demand that's involved in the right to the city better than I can. Let me just finish on a personal note. Much of what I've said, I expect, would be quite consistent with the politics of what Peter has been doing and the intellectual work. And so more than 2 years ago, I got a phone call from Peter saying, could we meet for dinner? He had a proposal. So we did, and when we met, very quickly, he was right into it. Now, wasn't it time that we met, when we met, that as intellectuals and political activists, we took seriously Lefebvre's admonition that we build the right to the city? Clearly, at that point, he had his eye already on the activist work that was going on. And the resulting, I have to say, somewhat chaotic confabulation at CUNY's Centre for Place, Culture and Politics, which I directed, has hardly brought about the urban revolution, but it has created a first step connecting intellectuals with political organisers dedicated to establishing that right to the city. So at 80 years old, I think Peter Marcuse is as indomitable and as useful a revolutionary for a new urban as ever he was. Thank you.
Thank you, Neil. We are continuing right away with our next two speakers. You're both going to speak. We have...